You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, what help is there for Afghans and Ukrainians looking to rebuild their lives in the United States? Welcome.us is at the center of the resettlement program. Jen White meets its CEO today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, scientists last summer published the most detailed biodiversity loss map ever created. The map shows parts of the United States where plant and animal species are at the highest risk of global extinction. But when you overlay that with a map of protected land, as the New York Times recently did, the two don't always match up. We're talking about the threat of losing animal and plant species and why the habitats of those species aren't always protected. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about biodiversity? Do you think more land needs to be protected one way or another for biodiversity? Are you involved in a project in your community or on your land, prairie restoration, for example, or other conservation efforts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Naughton is a professor in the geography department at UW-Madison. She studies biodiversity conservation in the tropics and has also studied wolf recovery in Wisconsin. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into the specifics of conservation, could you just talk a little bit about the value of biodiversity? Why do we worry about the risks to plant and animal species?
Well, for one, it has deep value in the quality of our lives. I was speaking with a colleague who lives in the North Woods, grew up in the North Woods, never dreamed that he would hear a wolf, but now he hears them with his young sons and just says it's an incalculable joy to hear that. So we have the sort of intrinsic value, the moral value of sharing our beautiful planet with all forms of life. But more and more, we're learning from ecologist studies that more diverse ecosystems are better able to be resilient to change, better able to bounce back from drought, to bounce back from fire. So that biodiversity in our ecosystems is also helping keep our ecosystems functioning, our water clear, and enhancing in a direct way the livability of our environment.
Now, I mentioned comparing and contrasting those two maps. So where we look at, okay, here are places with threats to biodiversity. Here are the lands we're really doing a lot to protect. They don't always line up. How hard is it to line up special protections of regions of land with where the greatest need is?
That's such a good question. And indeed, all too often, protected areas, as valuable as they are, our protected areas were established in places that were perceived as having low agricultural value or low economic potential. So that left out some of our precious ecosystems like native grasslands, or given the timing of the establishment of many of our parks and reserves, it left out the southeastern part of the country, the lower Appalachias, places where there was no open public land to set aside. It was all under private property. So the challenge persists. Some of our most species-rich habitats are on private lands outside of parks and reserves.
Sometimes I think it can seem like an all or nothing. This land is completely protected, no human involvement here. This is private land developed. But of course, in reality, there's a lot of middle ground. Do you see a lot of potential to find sort of halfway measures where we can take that private land or that partially developed land and still keep biodiversity in mind?
Yeah, we have to. That's the challenge before us. Biodiversity demands that we manage our ecosystems at a landscape level. Protected areas are essential, but they're inadequate. We just can't set aside a big enough area that biodiversity will be guaranteed. So we have to work with private landowners. That inevitably involves some compromise, but it's urgent. I was just thinking of a happy story amid all the biodiversity sad stories. I think it's important to remember how in this very state, we have now eagles nesting in every county. The DNR and Madison Audubon just announced that. In fact, I heard it on NPR and looked it up. That is thanks to laws that were passed in 1972 against DDT. As a girl, and like many of your listeners, perhaps as children, you didn't see great blue herons or bald eagles, and now they've bounced back. I bring that up also because it shows that we need to keep our eye on biodiversity beyond protected areas. We need to keep our eye on agricultural land use and industrial land use that may have cascading effects for biodiversity. And with effort, we can push back. We can turn things around for some species.
Talking to Lisa Naughton, professor in the Geography Department at UW-Madison, about efforts to protect and preserve biodiversity in the United States and beyond. I want to go beyond now, Lisa. You've done work in the tropics where there is a lot of biodiversity. What kind of efforts, hopefully successful efforts, have you seen in your work to protect some of the most biodiverse parts of the planet?
Well, much of my work is in Latin America, and to a certain extent, the protected areas were established there in the 1970s and more recently, when biodiversity was a clearer goal. And so they are, many of them, better placed to save biodiversity in tropical Latin America, say. The challenge is...
I think we've lost Lisa there. We'll see if we can bring her back. We're talking about biodiversity efforts to protect it. Coming up, we're going to meet a Wisconsin effort that's trying to protect the whole watershed around Lake Superior. Lisa, do we have you back? We do not. We will pick up that part of the conversation coming up. And you could join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in efforts maybe on your own land or in your community to preserve habitat for, well, what? Tell us what habitat you've been working to preserve, whether it's prairie or forest or wetland. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up our conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about at-risk species in our state and beyond, ways to protect biodiversity. We've got Lisa Naughton back with us from UW-Madison, and also joining us now, Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy, an organization that seeks to protect Lake Superior and the Laurentian Forest Province in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. He's also the founder of Milwaukee Riverkeeper, an environmental advocacy organization for the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick Rivers. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, go ahead.
The Superior Bioconservancy is looking to really protect the biodiversity of this region. And if you think of it just in terms of what's biodiversity, what's important is that you are an organism, your body. So within your body, you have viruses and bacteria, millions of these and fungi that basically operate and keep your system running. So one of the most important features of keeping biodiversity is understanding the function of what things do and why it's important. So you wouldn't go into your car and take the carburetor and throw it away just because you didn't like the way it looked or way it smelled. So there's a health of the system is, and we have two keystone species that are very important for the functionality of this region in our North Woods. And those wetlands up there are some of the most biodiverse that we have. Those are our coral reefs or our tropical rainforests in terms of species richness, let's say per square meter. And so there's two species that have a significance in Wisconsin, beavers and wolves. And wolves help the forest significantly because they affect how deer browse. And before we had the landscape, so back to 1973, when the Endangered Species Act was enacted, there were probably about 200 wolves in northeast Minnesota. Now there's about 4,400 going across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula. So the function that they provide is they basically frighten the deer and they change their behavior to more of a predator-prey relationship. And deer will remove up to 40% of the plant species if they're unregulated and they just keep growing. It's like having a herd of goats. So these other species like Canadian yew or white cedar, when they disappear, the forest itself becomes less robust, and there's because of its loss of species richness, because forests are a community of plants. If you have a pack of wolves, they are wide ranging. So you might have 75 miles for a pack of a pack range for, let's say, five wolves. So that's about 15 square miles per one wolf. And the forest, the function of it is they serve almost like an antibody, so that they change the behavior. So these areas where they frequent, you get this regeneration of all these species that get eliminated when you have too many deer.
And in just a minute, Bob, I want to ask about some of the specifics of the work of how you're working to preserve that. Lisa, we've got you back in now. What we're hearing from Bob there, is that an example of the kind of work we have to do in biodiversity in any particular ecosystem?
Yes, indeed. I couldn't agree more that we're not aiming at just collecting a certain species. We're trying to keep that web of life going and the interactions between those keystone species and the habitat.
And Bob, what you were just talking about, you're working on, you know, not just in one place, one forest, you're kind of working around almost the entire lakeshore and beyond of Lake Superior. Can you talk about just the scope of your effort to preserve the species and ecosystems you were just describing?
Right. So if you take the whole United States side, which is the national forests, county forests, and state forests of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, it's 21 million acres. And what we are mapping is connecting corridors to put linkages between these corridors to avoid fragmentation, to allow genetic exchange, and really to have evolution to continue. So no different than you need to be able to go to the bank, the hardware store, or the grocery store. Animals need to be able to migrate and populate and fluctuate across this landscape. And one of the key features that we're interested in seeing is introduction, so to speak, of allowing beavers to thrive across the landscape, because they affect the hydrology. So what beavers, it isn't just a critter, but when they build dams, this is a type of architecture that completely changes the hydrology of the rivers. So if we want healthy rivers, rivers that are less likely to flood, and each one of these ponds that they build also are one of the richest areas where we have for biodiversity, for great blue herons, ducks, and birds, because they become the engines of productivity. So we're looking across this landscape as sort of a regional planning for the ecology of the area, but also looking at its carbon aspect. So it's a high carbon landscape. And we hope to also continue up into the Canadian side, into Ontario. So the entire watershed of Lake Superior is protected, in essence. This is the most important freshwater body in this hemisphere, perhaps probably the most important and the purest in the world. So its volume of water and its future for the planet as a freshwater resource, and how those inputs, all those rivers and watersheds that drain into that, need to be in a type of status that they are functioning at high ecological value, because its essence, it's saving ourselves as well as saving our landscape here in the upper Midwest.
And Bob, I wanted to ask more about beavers in particular. For a long time, they were an economic resource for their fur. There are places in the country where they're seen as a nuisance by property owners because they change the hydrology. And you don't want that in your yard necessarily. How do you start to build a consensus in a community, whether it's along Lake Superior or maybe even in Milwaukee County, that, hey, they are neighbors we want?
It's an excellent question. It's really a coexistence. It's a coexistence issue. So you can control the levels of flooding that beavers, to avoid nuisance flooding, using flow devices. So this uses like a stack pipe, and you run a pipe through the dam, or you put a type of fencing around culverts or places that you don't want them to blocking. So you can work with them effectively in a co-management way. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has the worst beaver policy in the United States because they don't recognize this ecological value. It's important to keep them where you can control them. But for the Milwaukee River, for instance, I worked on a study with two university professors, and we showed by if we had beavers reinstated in the upper Milwaukee River watershed, for example, we would lower peak flood levels in downtown Milwaukee 37%. Now, that from an economic value, ecosystem service value, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, which has flood authority and paid for the study, for them, that's worth over $3 billion in flood relief. So where you could have beavers have an advantage for you is by mitigating flooding. So with climate change, we're getting instability in the system, and so we're getting big rains occasionally. We've had big flooding in pockets of area, and you can, in essence, re-strengthen your whole hydrology of all your rivers. In pre-settlement, our rivers were completely different. So it's a matter of thinking of this as how can we live with this animal and get the benefits and also the biodiversity, water quality, recharging aquifers benefit.
And Lisa, when we lost you earlier, you were talking about Central America in particular, and that what Bob was just talking about, building neighborhoods and partnerships between humans and the other animals and species. Have you seen success stories like that in your work in Central America?
Yes, definitely. I've seen success stories. It's I must say, though, it's challenging that enlisting local community members means expanding the different goals that the landscape is managed for, and there's often conflict. One of the places I work in South America, there's a gold rush underway. Very poor people, very biodiverse, carbon-heavy forest, but full of gold. And in such situations, the sort of shared management becomes very difficult.
We're talking to Lisa Naughton from UW-Madison and Bob Boucher, president and founder of the Superior Bio Conservancy, looking at wildlife habitat preservation, biodiversity preservation in Wisconsin and around the world. Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see the DOT start planting trees in our native plants inland so we could leave our wetlands alone and, bring back the native bees and birds and things inland.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Bob, you're thinking about Lake Superior, but you're doing work well inland. Is that part of the story, native plants, trees, native bees?
Well, forests provide carbon, and what we're looking at is changing some of the policies on the national forest, the county forest, and state forest. Those trees provide a more stable environment for us by standing. You can still have forestry, but we need to allow a lot of it to go back to an old growth type of status. You get a whole structure there that allows certain species to thrive, like goshawks and martens, that we don't have, though they're both endangered in Wisconsin, because we don't have any old forests to speak of, that most people don't recognize that we had trees that were 400 or 500 years old. And to walk in those types of environments is a very unique and in many ways sort of a spiritual experience. It's a cathedral.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Michael in Wauwatosa. Michael, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to throw in my support for what your guest is speaking of. As far as the beavers, I've gone through hikes through Schwamigan and Nicolet, and I can see these old beaver dams that I just look back and I see what they created and the diversity. And now it's some of them are dried up, the pond that would have been back there. And I just wish that the DNR, that the state would allow a beaver sanctuaries in certain areas, like in the Schwamigan and Nicolet. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is I've got property in north central Wisconsin, and I'm big on planting native trees and especially oaks. And I have to wire up every tree at least 5 feet high, make a cage around it with woven steel, because if I don't, the deer will just strip the leaves off. And I think the deer have created an ecological disaster in a lot of areas. They've devastated the understory and anything that, consequently, that since there's no understory, the wildlife that would have depended on them is gone. And I'm just thrilled to have the wolves back in the area, and I'm a longtime deer hunter.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Bob, Michael, a lot of what he said lined up with what you were talking about earlier. It makes me think at a wider level, are there things that individual landowners or maybe businesses or communities that own land can do to help with the kind of work you're doing on around Lake Superior and elsewhere?
Well, yeah, by having beavers in the landscape, the current, for instance, management of beavers in Wisconsin is 5 months long, unlimited season. They don't keep track of who gets what. So it's an unregulated season. So if you had anything where you don't have any limits, you don't keep track of what you have, you don't know what you have. So it's a very poor management policy. Wolves provide the type of service that, they move the deer around, and your forests are really damaged significantly by deer. When you have wolves on it, your forest is healthier, and because it has this other diversity to it and as a community. So from a productivity standpoint, just from a public standpoint of getting more wood pulp and a healthier forest, more robust and more carbon, having wolves is probably the cheapest, easiest, healthiest thing we can do for ourselves.
And for people who want to do landscape restoration, things like that, Bob, are there ways they can work with your organization to be, part of the bigger picture?
Well, we can try to get support for understanding that to avoid fragmentation and vote for people who vote for the environment and for biodiversity and recognize that we need to have that. It's the system we live in. The earth is an organism. We live in it as an organism, and its health and our health are completely directly related. With the climate crisis, there's also a biodiversity crisis. The UN has agreed to that. We lack political will in a way. And so there needs to be voices like your caller there to address this issue and demand action because it's critical.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa, thanks for staying with us.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
I've been talking to Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy. That's an organization that seeks to protect Lake Superior and the Laurentian Forest Province in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. Also with us, Lisa Naughton, professor in the Geography Department at UW-Madison. Both of them work on issues related to biodiversity in Wisconsin and beyond. Still time to share your story. If you work with a conservation effort in your community or elsewhere, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us. You can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. It's election day in Wisconsin, and elections can often get people reflecting on how things are going in their lives at the state, local, national, and international levels. Are we prospering? If yes, do we reward the incumbents? If no, do we give someone else a chance? Well, we don't have any state or nationwide races on the ballot today. There are a lot of domestic and global issues to reflect on. And our next guest is offering reasons for us to be positive about America's position in all of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How prosperous do you feel like the United States is in this moment? What does prosperity look like to you? Do you feel like the country is on a strong economic footing in its recovery from the early days of the pandemic? What threats do you see to American prosperity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Koplovich is a professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He's director of European Studies at UW. He recently wrote in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about what he believes to be America's ongoing, enduring prosperity and strength, despite inflation, the war in Ukraine, and other problems. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again. It's nice to be back.
I want to talk about the why, first of all. You wrote this piece. You said a feeling of skepticism, pessimism out there in the American media and the public.
Yes. So, I wrote this mainly as a reaction to what I've been seeing in terms of the public and political debate about the state of the economy in the United States. We have just lived through a 2-year pandemic, which is unprecedented. But we've also had an unprecedentedly rapid and successful economic recovery. Right. So unemployment was nearly 15% in April of 2020. And by pretty much every metric in terms of jobs, income, consumption, investment, whatever economic activity you're talking about, we've had basically a full recovery economically since the onset of the pandemic, which is, by comparison to the global financial crisis, it took us over a decade and we never really fully recovered, or the Great Depression, which took years and years to recover from. That was sort of my reaction was, yes, inflation is high and inflation is higher than it's been in a very long time. But inflation is high around the world, right? The levels of U.S. inflation are roughly the levels of inflation that you're seeing in the European Union countries, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, et cetera. And so it just sort of seems to me there's a bit of a disconnect between how well the U.S. economy is actually doing and has recovered And we've had a much better and faster recovery than the other countries I just mentioned. And the state of the political debate, which is, you know, the U.S. economy is terrible, right? You know, unemployment is incredibly low right now. Inflation certainly is eroding people's incomes now. But if you actually look at the data and factor in the money that most households received from stimulus checks and the child credits and all of the policies that were put into place by the U.S. government over the last year or so, real income and real consumption actually haven't gone down, right? So it seems there's a sort of a disconnect between how much the public is suffering and how bad the economy is doing, and what the data suggest is the U.S. economy is actually doing well, very strong, both in absolute terms and relative to other countries that we might compare ourselves to.
In your piece, you refer to some surveys showing the American public worried about the economy. There's been some other survey data where Americans think unemployment has gone up in recent months when it's gone down. I want to throw in a word here that might account for the discrepancy between the data you're pointing toward and how people feel: uncertainty. All through COVID, it seems like there's always another shoe we're waiting for to drop. Do you think that may account for some of that difference?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, we're living through unprecedented times, and is uncertainty about the geopolitics and war, about the state of the economy, about the next wave of the coronavirus pandemic. I think what that's what a lot of the public opinion surveys are picking up. You know, I do also think that there's an aspect of framing and media cues and coverage. I think one of the things I mentioned in the op-ed is the ratio. I've been tracking the amount of coverage about inflation relative to unemployment in the media for the last year or so. And it's something on the order on a month-to-month basis of about a 12-to-1 ratio of articles on inflation versus unemployment, right? And actually in the last couple of months, that ratio is more like 20-to-40-to-1. And so I think, you know, we saw this the last few weeks with gas prices, that people hear a lot about inflation is really high, it's a huge problem, here's what's going on with gas prices. There's been relatively little coverage about, you know, the unemployment rate has fallen from the highest level it's been in 80 years to the lowest level it's been in 80 years in the last 10 months, right? And, you know, I think that it's the combination of both of those things, and obviously politics as well, right? You know, in any political system, the opposition party has lots of incentive to say that the economy is doing poorly and blame the incumbents for what's going on. And, you know, that's a feature of politics. It's not something that's specific to the United States, but I think some of that is what's going on as well.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, he wrote a piece saying, hey, America, the United States is more prosperous than you might think it is. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our calls, Mark, one question is, okay, compared to what? And there's, I think, a concern that, okay, China is on the rise. Russia is this threat. We've got these rival countries representing different government systems. And there's a fear that somehow they're doing better than us, gaining on us, overtaking us in some way.
Right. And this is actually, you know, the what we've been talking about so far was kind of the short-term set of developments that I've been thinking about. But the other reason I wrote this piece is the longer-term developments and narratives. You know, the point is not to deny that there are serious problems in the United States, economic and politically, or that, you know, households and individuals aren't facing hard times because of inflation. But if you look at the problems of the U.S. relative to the challenges and difficulties that China and Russia face, we are unquestionably stronger, right? And the big thing I wrote about in the piece was on the monetary and financial side. You know, I study the economic side of international relations. And, you know, one of the things you've actually seen is that on display in the last several weeks with the Western sanctions led by the U.S. on Russia. Right? The U.S. the global economy runs on dollars. Interest rates are unprecedentedly low. And the United States' ability both to borrow and invest and spend is, you know, much, much stronger than China's or Russia's. There are political questions about whether we will do that. And there's political debates about debt and deficits, but our ability to actually borrow and spend is unprecedented. And what we saw with the sanctions was, you know, in a very, very short amount of time, the U.S., along with our NATO allies and European Union allies, and the Canadians and the Japanese, were basically able to completely choke off Russia from the global economy because the world economy runs on dollars and euros. And the financial sanctions have basically targeted Russia. And Russia has the ruble, and the ruble is not a global reserve currency. China has the renminbi. The renminbi is becoming somewhat more important in the world economy, but 60% of foreign exchange reserves that governments hold are dollars. Another 25% are euros. 2% are Chinese renminbi, right? And so there's a, you know, I think a lot of the debate about China, because China is large and they're big in terms of international trade, is that they're sort of surpassing the U.S. But when you look at things both on the military side and even more so on the money and financial side, the gap between the U.S. and China is still very large. And the gap between the U.S. and China on the one hand and Russia on the other is enormous.
We're talking to Mark Koplovich, professor in the political science department at UW-Madison. He says, despite multiple challenges, American prosperity is going pretty well right now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with what you're hearing from our guest? What questions do you have? What factors do you weigh when you weigh the American economy? Call 800-642-1234. We'll hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about American prosperity and global strength, including financial strength. Mark Koplovich stays with us, professor in the Political Science Department and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I work in the electrical industry. In the past 3 years, my income has gone down from 32 to 28,000 last year. I've worked more hours. I actually got a raise, but my buying power has decreased as well because I'm paying twice as much for gasoline. My insurance has gone up. My food costs have gone up. And even in the industry, copper prices have gone up. Aluminum has hit an all-time high. I mean, I do not see this as prosperity. I totally disagree with this professor. He needs to get out in the real world and talk to real people. The people who are building homes are borrowing money in order to pay these high prices. We're leveraging our prosperity on our future.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Mark?
Yeah. I appreciate the comment. I have been out. I have talked to lots of people. There are the aggregate numbers and there are the distributional effects, right? And it's important to think about, even when the U.S. economy is doing well, not everybody and not every sector of the economy is doing well. That is true in normal times and was true pre-pandemic. And there are a lot of distributional inequities. Some of those are urban versus rural. Some of those are one sector versus another sector. All of that is true, right? And there's enormous number of things that could be done to help individuals and to help households policy-wise that the U.S. government and the state government haven't done over many years, right? Prior to the pandemic, in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. All of that is unquestionably true. And at the same time, as Rob, we were talking about earlier, the sort of compared to what question is to think about what the U.S. economy would have been like had we not had the economic policy response that we had, right? So the data that I've seen is that the average U.S. household received about $3,500 from the American Rescue Plan and the child tax credits and earned income tax credit, the set of policies we put in place in response to the pandemic economic crisis. And so in the absence of that, things would have been far worse, right? And it's true that households are spending more on food. It's true that households are spending more on utilities, they're spending more on gas when they go to the pump, et cetera. But if you net all of those things out for the average household, again, real income didn't decline, right, in the last year. And that's due to the policy response, right? And the policy response was deeply divisive politically. It was unpopular in large parts of the country, but it was unquestionably beneficial for the average household. And the U.S. economy has recovered, amongst the G7 industrialized economies. We are, I believe, the only economy that now actually has recovered and surpassed the 2020 levels. And so the policy response that we put in place relative to the UK, relative to EU countries, relative to Japan, et cetera, was much more aggressive and extensive. And it actually, you know, insured American households and American individuals to a degree that other countries didn't. Right. So again, as I was thinking about writing this, you know, the it's not that people haven't felt the pain of these crises, right? And it's not that everyone in the country has benefited. But in relative terms, right, both to China and Russia and relative to other countries we might compare ourselves to, the state of the U.S. economy is very, very strong. And the state of the economy relative to what it would have been absent the aggressive monetary and fiscal policy response is very, very good. Right. And again, I think that's absent from a lot of the media discussion, which is almost exclusively focused on inflation.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Tony joins us now in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I just disagree with this guy, and I'm going to tell you why, because he brings up averages. Well, me and LeBron James, if we average out our salary, we're making a lot of million dollars. But in the real world, I'm making about $50,000 a year, and LeBron James is making about $70 million a year. And the inflation doesn't bother him as much as it does me. But also at the same time, every time we have one of these recessions or something like that, it hits working class people harder and harder every single time. And the recoveries take longer and longer. Unemployment is not counted fully. Unemployment is only the people collecting unemployment, not people that are all on unemployment who stop looking for jobs or their skill sets do not meet new jobs because of lack of training resources.
Tony, I got you. We don't have too much time left. You gave us a lot to work with there. Mark, first of all, are we taking into account the inequity between Tony and LeBron James, for example, when we factor out the overall economy?
We are in the data. I mean, there, you know, the difference between the average and the median, which is the middle person, we are capturing that. But on the point about how we measure unemployment, you know, there's lots of different ways. You can look at labor force participation. You can look at real wages. You can look at the unemployment rate. You can look at unemployment by sector. Across all of these dimensions, we have returned to the levels that we were at prior to February 2020 and the onset of the pandemic. Right. So again, as I said with the previous callers, it's the point is not to say that everything is equal and fair and that everyone in the economy is doing well. But you know, the state of the economy relative to where we were 2 years ago, we had something that was as serious as the Great Depression, is as serious as the global financial crisis. And the economy on average, and for most Americans, has recovered, right? And that doesn't mean that it's better for everybody. And it doesn't mean that obviously LeBron James is not bothered by inflation when he goes to the pump in the way that the caller was, or I am, or you are. But, you know, for most Americans, the situation of the economy now, relative to what it was, and the state of the economy relative to what we hear about how awful everything is, and this is the worst things have been in 40 years, I think there's a very large disconnect.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Mark Hoplovich, professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We talked with him today about his piece on American prosperity. You can find the link to that Journal Sentinel piece at wpr.org/centraltime. Also, Mark is going to chair a related forum. It's coming up on May 4th for the La Follette School. It's called American Power, Prosperity, and Democracy. That'll be live at Monona Terrace in Madison with a virtual option as well. Today's school board elections will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box, students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard.
Allie Schlicht is a junior at La Crosse's Central High School, where she's on the debate team. She's also part of a group of students in La Crosse who are working to connect the candidates in the local school board race to the students they'd be making decisions for.
That's probably always a concern of students, is a lot of times they just don't feel heard by adults. So that is something that we are or I am looking for in a school board candidate is somebody who would listen to students.
Allie and other students with the youth advocacy group Leaders Igniting Transformation organized forums for the school board candidates, where they asked about some of the issues they most want to see addressed.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction data from the 2018...
At a forum in March, Kaylin Adams noted that Black students are disproportionately likely to be suspended in lacrosse schools.
As a school board member, how would you go about reducing racial disparities and school discipline?
Kaylin got involved with lobbying the school board after going to racial justice protests in the summer of 2020 sparked her interest in political action.
The most only thing we could really do is just say what we need to say and then hope that it gets taken into consideration.
With the voting age at 18 and up, typically only seniors, and not even all of them, can vote for school board members. Allie says a board that answers more to students would probably look a little different.
I think a lot of the candidates would be focusing their campaign more on reaching those students and really seeing what they wanted more. Most likely also would be focusing their campaign strategies towards addressing the problems that students feel the most concerned about.
For the lacrosse students, one of those problems is mental health. They even successfully lobbied their board to put $100,000 of the school's federal relief funds toward mental health services. They also say addressing racial disparities and reducing the district's carbon footprint should be priorities. Some Wisconsin school boards have given students a literal seat at the table, if not a vote. Menominee Falls, Sun Prairie, Howard Suamico, and other districts have 2 non-voting student seats on their board. Bayport junior Kara Reen joined the Howard Suamico board in spring 2021, a contentious time when the state mask mandate had just been overturned and school boards were scrambling for next steps.
It was just very, very fiery school meetings for around since I joined. So being part of that, I think, just gives me more awareness about what's going on in my community.
She says all the uproar can be frustrating. Kara would like to see the board be able to focus on issues the student body cares about, like support and funding for social-emotional learning or equity and educational access, especially in areas like math and technology.
Really, this is about students from elementary to high school and being ready for the future. As a student, I just don't want the board to constantly have petty fights over things that really aren't about students or school board issues.
Rohan Gala is a Bayport senior and the other student board member. He says national arguments over race and library books and LGBTQ issues have been overtaking board meetings in Wisconsin. That's created what he calls a heightened tension around school board meetings.
Parents and the community members now see the importance of school board meetings and the things that school boards talk about. And so while I would like to see a lessening of tensions within the school board, I also don't think that that could happen.
In the meantime, Kara, Allie, and Kaylin say they've seen more of their fellow students interested in this year's school board elections than ever before. The students say they may not stay engaged with these school boards forever, especially if they move away for college or work. But it has made them passionate about political engagement and how they can make their voices heard. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.